AR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Pope John Paul II's recent hospitalization has drawn attention again to the Pontiff's fragility and ill health. The 84-year-old church leader suffers from Parkinson's disease and was hospitalized for flu complications. What impact has John Paul II had on the church during his rule of more than a quarter century? Who will succeed him as leader of the world's 1 billion Catholics? Those are two of the questions I raised in an interview with the author of Heirs of the Fishermen, Behind the Scenes of Papal Death and Succession, John Peter Pham. John Peter Pham is a frequent writer and commentator on religious and public affairs. He served as a Vatican diplomat as well as an aide to both the Vicar General of His Holiness for the Vatican and the president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. He is now a member of the faculty of the Center for Liberal and Applied Social Sciences at James Madison University. John Peter Pham's book, Heirs of the Fishermen, is published by the Oxford University Press. I spoke with Pham Monday, February 21st, 2005, as this interview is recorded. No phone calls today. At the beginning of our discussion, I asked John Peter Pham to talk a bit about the Pope's determination to continue his work.
Certainly, it's not surprising. He's, throughout his life, shown himself to be an exceptionally determined individual. That, of course, is not without its critics at certain moments in his governance of the church, but certainly one would have not expected anything less from him than his determination to continue. And also part of that is also the very unhappy history of popes who have not continued in office. It's certainly not an example that is comforting to anyone that would contemplate the thought of resignation.
Yeah, if a pope steps down, and it's my understanding that of the 263 men who preceded John Paul II, only one left the papacy before his death.
Actually, a number left the papacy. The first one was actually Pontian in the 3rd century. He resigned when he was arrested and condemned to the salt mines of Sardinia during the persecutions of the church in the Roman Empire, and because he realized it was a death sentence, essentially, to be sent away to the salt mines of Sardinia. So he resigned in 235 and died afterwards. But there have been several other less happy examples. The last pope to voluntarily retire from office was Celestine V, who in 1296 resigned. But then, as he became a focal point for those who opposed his successor, Boniface VIII, Boniface ended up locking him up in a jail cell for the rest of his natural life. So certainly that's not a happy example. The very last pope to resign was Gregory XII, who resigned in the 15th century, the beginning of that period, to as part of the ending of the Western Schism when there were rival Clements to the papal office.
Now today, though, a pope wouldn't face such unhappy consequences of his retirement, would he?
No, certainly one wouldn't expect his successor to lock him up as Boniface locked up Celestine. On the other hand, given the technology in which we live today, instant communications, a retired pope, if one can use that term, even though canon law provides for the fact that the pope has a right to resign and his resignation does not need to be accepted by anyone, it's his personal decision. However, a pope who would theoretically resign today would, in fact, pose a bit of a problem, however unwillingly, for his successor. And the fact that if his successor adopted any policies that differed from his, there would always be the people, the internet bloggers and whatever else, who would then question the legitimacy of the resignation, whether the pope would resign had truly done so freely. And they could easily, with the internet and other media resources, galvanize a division within the church very easily.
Yeah. A new book by the Pope, Memory and Identity, is coming out in Europe this month. Does that suggest the Pope has, until fairly recently anyway, been able to work despite his illness and frailty?
Well, certainly that's what many in the Vatican hope to portray, the image of a pope that is, he was continuing to work, whether the work itself is actually that of the pope or published under his name, that's an open question that I think historians will look at in future years. Certainly from the very beginning of the pontificate of John Paul II, many of the things that were put out in his name were very clearly written by other people. And it's like that with any world leader, any president, prime minister, has speech writers and drafters of documents. And that's certainly been the case with the pope. For example, one of the men who's spoken of as a possible successor to John Paul II, Dionigio Tettamanzi, now the Cardinal Archbishop of Milan, has certainly not been secretive about the fact that he wrote several of John Paul's encyclicals regarding moral theology.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting because, you know, one of the Pope's accomplishments is his writings, and as you note in Heirs of the Fishermen, during his pontificate, he's promulgated an extraordinarily voluminous corpus of official documents. In addition to being the first pontiff to publish personal theological and religious works while in office, since the ill-fated John the 22nd, a pope of the 14th century. What would you like to say, then, about the content and quality of his writings?
Well, certainly, for Catholics at least, the doctrinal value of his writings do not depend on who the human author of the actual text was, as long as they were issued in the name and with the authority of the pope. The same way, in any government, presidential orders are valid regardless of which West Wing staffer drafted them for signature. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, certainly the corpus stands on its own merits and will be assessed favorably and unfavorably over the course of time to see what remains standing and what is only temporary. But that being said, certainly historians in the future will examine to what extent John Paul personally contributed to the corpus. Certainly, some of the very early writings bear a very close resemblance to writings from earlier periods in his career, so very clearly his definitive mark on them. The extent to which his later writings of recent years bear that mark, I think, remains to be analyzed.
Hmm. How will church leaders sort through these writings in the future? Will they continue to be important in the life of the church?
Certainly, John Paul has intended for them to be. He has, unlike his two immediate predecessors, spoken very definitively on a number of hotly debated issues within the church, including clerical celibacy, the role of women in the church, questions of contraception, and other issues. And he's tried to speak in a very definitive manner that, in a way, locks his successors into that legacy. On the other hand, as with any writings in the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, one really has to go back to that test that's found actually in the New Testament. If it is of God, it will remain, and there's nothing that can be done about it. If it is of men, it will pass away, and ultimately, history alone will judge.
Hmm. When people talk about this pope and his accomplishments, his role in the fall of communism is often mentioned. A couple questions here. What role did he play, and would it have happened without him?
Well, communism itself was a system that, if we look at it socially, politically, morally, was itself doomed. But John Paul contributed, I think, significantly, along with late President Reagan, Baroness Thatcher, and Mikhail Gorbachev, to hastening that demise. Certainly his election galvanized Poland in a way that if another man had been elected pope, yes, the polls would have been restive and there would have been disputes, but they would not have galvanized in the same manner. And certainly the Solidarity Movement in Poland and the eventual democratization that brought in Poland pulled the rug out from under the Soviet Empire. So in that sense, his being a Pole, a nationalist, in the good sense of nationalism, helped speed things along. Also, the role that he played with his great sensitivity to Eastern Europe in trying to bring Eastern Europe now into one Europe. He's been very outspoken about that. In fact, one of his last pronouncements before his recent hospitalization was the encouragement of the expansion of the European Union. So in many ways, his personal history contributed a great deal to it.
So his identity as a Pole, as someone who lived under a totalitarian regime, has affected his papacy.
Very much so.
Yeah. The Pope has been very critical of fascism and communism. He's also been critical of materialism. He champions human rights, yet he essentially silenced liberation theology in Latin America. What were the Pope's objections to liberation theology?
His primary objection was that what he saw was, actually there were two primary objections. One was a philosophical. Many people tend to forget that John Paul is first and foremost, as an individual, a philosopher. An outstanding philosopher, academically speaking, in his own right, before becoming a bishop and cardinal and pope. And so he had a philosophical objection to the use of Marxism as an analytical tool in and of itself. Within the church, he found that the Marxist analysis, in a way, ignored an important dimension of man that the church is to bear witness to, the spiritual dimension, focusing almost exclusively in its material manifestations. That he had a difficulty with. Another difficulty he had with it was the what he saw as the role of many of the liberation theologians in privileging their social action above what John Paul, who's somewhat mystical in his personal orientation, viewed as their primary function as priests and religious.
Hmm. It's interesting. The Pope is on the one hand very political, and then he's critical of becoming politically engaged. Is that contradictory?
Well, in many ways, his very position as Pope is itself a tension between the assertion of a very political role that certainly John Paul has seen grow during his pontificate. Currently, the Vatican maintains diplomatic relations with 172 of the 192 countries in the world. That's up by almost 100% from when he became Pope. He doubled the diplomatic activity. On the other hand, he's also focused very much on the interior aspects of the church, a little less, some would say, on social action and more on doctrinal conformity, renewal. In many respects, I think, one can see that tension growing out of his own experience, first in Nazi-occupied Poland during the Second World War, and then communist-ruled Poland in the post-war period, where the church had to both play a function vis-a-vis government and authority to speak truth to power, and on the other hand, had to maintain a cohesiveness within in order to survive.
Hmm. How significant is the diplomatic activity of the papacy in world affairs today?
It's very subtle, but it's there. In many international conferences, controversially, in recent years, papal diplomacy has allied itself with diplomats of third world countries, especially what we would call in America Islamist states, to block the passage of certain resolutions, such as at the Conference on Population, the UN Conference on Women, especially opposing any expansion of reproductive freedoms or rights in that sector. So in many ways, it's shown its forte. Last year, almost unnoticed, the United Nations General Assembly unanimously passed a resolution which granted the Vatican as the Holy See a status as a non-state observer at the United Nations, recognizing its full right to full membership it ever chose to, but recognizing its choice not to go for full membership, but according to all the privileges nonetheless, including participation in committees, the ability to co-sponsor UN resolutions, etc.
Hmm. So subtle but significant.
Yes.
Yeah. How open to debate, to dialogue, has the Pope been with those who see issues differently than he does?
You know, a number of writers, I think, not without justification, notice that there's a tendency to dialogue with an openness to dialogue with almost anyone and everyone outside the church. The Pope has promoted, in a way none of his predecessors ever has, interreligious dialogue, not just with among Christian communities, but with Buddhists, Muslims, and even traditional believers from some of the African traditional religions. The Pope has also made common cause during the millennium, for example, on debt relief with rock stars and other figures. On the other hand, within the church, there's a certain ossification or that sense that there must be interior unity, even at the cost of openness and frank dialogue, which I think will be one of the factors that will weigh in when one ultimately, in the light of history, examines this pontificate.
Mm. What has shaped his ideas on sexuality?
I think a number of things. One is his own personal experience of pastoral ministry in Poland. He certainly has a great sensitivity to it, unlike some of his earlier writings show a great deal of sensitivity to sexuality, an amazing one when one considers the times he was writing in the 50s and 60s behind the Iron Curtain. On the other hand, his mystical streak often also comes to the fore, and some of the expectations are in a certain sense not in conformity with certainly attitudes on the street in Western Europe, North America, and other places. So there is a tension. To what extent that tension is a call to people to a higher standard, and to what extent is it somewhat of a passé retrograde obscurantism, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Fatima, important to him, and the Virgin Mary. What would you like to say about that?
Well, certainly there's been a very mystical self-identification with Fatima. He was the attempt to assassinate him by the Turkish gunman occurred on the feast of Our Lady of Fatima in 1981. And the Pope has always attributed the fact that he survived to the intercession of Our Lady of Fatima, the apparitions that took place at Fatima in 1917. And he has seen himself identified with the so-called third secret of Fatima as the Pope who will be shot down but will rise again and somehow lead the people of God into some sort of new era. Now, even within the church, even among those who might be considered relatively conservative Orthodox theologians, there's a certain uneasiness at the sort of millenarist self-interpretation. So it's one of those items that I think one ought to put a careful reserve on and reflect on back in life history, because John Paul is not the first pope who in his last years made such an identification. Most people forget that in the 1950s, Pope Pius XII engaged in the same sort of speculation of self-identification with this mystical figure, and at one point had his vicar general, an archpriest for the Vatican Basilica, a cardinal, stand up and proclaim that the Pope had witnessed by himself, since no one else in Rome saw it, the miracle of the sun on Vatican Hill. Hmm. So, there is a history to this.
Yeah. The Pope, of course, has his fans and his critics. Some would call him the greatest Pope of the 20th century. Others would say that honor is John the 23rd's. How do you assess John Paul's papacy? How might we, outsiders, assess a Pope's rule on the throne of Peter?
Well, I would say any Pope should be, and any figure really, should be assessed in light of their own self-definition. And if one looks at the various titles that the Pope holds, that provides really the self-definition there, one who is defined both as Bishop of Rome, the Bishop of a particular church in Rome, also as a shepherd within the church, and also as this global figure. And those are the elements of the Pope's title. They're also the elements to assess him. But I would caution against this quick assessment, almost this desire to canonize him the moment he breathes his last, because history has shown us that those types of judgments are best made with a little bit of distance. If one looked at, for example, Pius XII, the longest reigning pope, just shy of 33 years, at his death, he was viewed very, very favorably, and those who were proclaiming him, you know, certainly the great. History has not been as kind to him when certain things have come to light. Pius XII, who died in 1958, the same way, fulsome tributes at the time of his passing. Now a great deal of scholarly debate over his role during the Nazi Holocaust of the Second World War. So I would say judgments about who are the greatest popes and who are the worst are best done in the light of history, using their own criteria, but with a step back, a little more dispassionately, and viewing them in the ensemble of their predecessors and within that context.
Mm. If you're just tuning in this afternoon, listeners, this is a recorded interview recorded on February 21st of 2005. The program is not live this afternoon, so we're not taking calls today. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. My guest, John Peter Pham, he is the author of Heirs of the Fisherman, Behind the Scenes of Papal Death and Succession. John Peter Pham has served as a Vatican diplomat and as an aide to both the Vicar General of His Holiness for the Vatican and the President of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. He is now a member of the faculty of the Center for Liberal and Applied Social Sciences at James Madison University. John Paul II has appointed all but five of the 135 men who will elect the next pope. Does that guarantee the next pope will share John Paul's philosophical and political views?
Well, that number has actually changed a little bit, Celeste,
okay.
Since I wrote those lines. It's now down to 119, and all but three of them are appointees of John Paul II. So, he's appointed an even greater proportion of the men who will elect a successor. That being said, however, the conventional wisdom about how much of an influence a pope exercises really doesn't stand the weight of historical analysis. Historically, the cardinals have recognized that as the pope passes away, the sovereignty is no longer his, but is theirs collectively. And they have often, either intentionally or unintentionally, bucked the previous pontiff. In 1958, to give you a recent example, the cardinals had every intention, almost all of them had been appointed by Pius XII, and their intention was clearly to continue his legacy but give the church a breather by electing an older appointee of his who would reign for a few years before passing on. So they elected the 77-year-old Cardinal Patriarch of Venice, Angelo Roncalli, who was overweight, asthmatic, and not due to live for very long and would presumably just continue along the path that Pius had laid out. Well, John the 23rd surprised them all. He didn't live long. That part didn't surprise anyone, just under 5 years. But in that 5 years, he summoned the Second Vatican Council and more or less turned Pius's world upside down.
Yeah.
So there's an example. Another example, going back just a little farther in history, 1878, all the cardinals who went into that conclave were appointed by Pius IX and were expected to elect someone like him. They elected another elderly figure, Cardinal Gioacchino Pecci, then 68, which was an advanced age for the 19th century. He outlived all but one of them and he's now the third longest reigning pope. John Paul last year surpassed his record. But Leo XIII, again, turned his predecessor's world upside down. So while the probabilities do exist for cardinals appointed by a certain pope to act in a certain manner, really all bets are off once a pope passes away.
Yeah. Do you think the fact that the pontiff has appointed all but just a couple of the electors will mean the swift selection of a successor?
In many ways, he's laid the foundations for the possibility of a very swift election, but also the possibility for a very prolonged one. if I may, give you a little bit of history. The popes are elected in what's called the conclave. The word comes from the Latin words with the key, the cardinals being historically, since at least the 13th century, locked up inside the Vatican Palace or one of the papal palaces to, in a rather uncomfortable setting, to force them to move quickly to an election. As late as 1978, the last conclave, for example, in the middle of the Roman summer, these elderly gentlemen were housed in makeshift rooms and corridors and proceeded rapidly at their business. John Paul, however, has made life a little more comfortable for the cardinals. He built, controversially within the Vatican, a palace, the Doma Sancta Marta, where each of the electors will now have his own suite. So now life is not as uncomfortable, so that physical pressure to hurry things up has changed. That element is no longer there. Added to that is a little change John Paul tweaked in the rules. Historically, to be elected pope, one had to be a consensus figure who could gain two-thirds or two-thirds plus one of the electors to be elected pope. John Paul has left that two-thirds requirement in place, but with one little exception. In 1996, he published what's called an apostolic constitution outlining the procedures for the election of a successor, and he left in there a little loophole that says basically that if the electors remain deadlocked, essentially after a week's time, they may, by simple majority, change the rules. So a simple majority, after a week, could change the rules and then elect a candidate by 50% plus one majority as opposed to the two-thirds consensus required. Mm-hmm. Now that they've got comfortable quarters, it is conceivable, at least, that the cardinals may while the week away and then change the rules and elect someone who's not necessarily a consensus figure, but who can garner a simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
So that possibility exists. Whether it will happen or not depends. Another variable, if I may, that is thrown into this is John Paul has internationalized the College of Cardinals. For the first time in history, Europeans and North Americans are no longer the majority. The majority belongs to the developing world. On the other hand, with changes in the church, including the loss of Latin as the language of the church, the 119 or whatever number of men ultimately gather will no longer be able to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
They no longer speak a common language. I remember a few years ago at the Vatican, there was a synod of bishops that I participated in, and there was a working groups broke out by language, and there was a Latin working group, and the only people who showed up to the Latin working group was one elderly bishop from Eastern Europe and yours truly as the scribe for that meeting. So that they will no longer be speaking the same language. They'll caucus by language groups. That already started happening in 1978, but I think that will be even more augmented this time around. So you'll have a lot of people who don't know each other as well. Now, there will be some high-profile cardinals who, with media, internet, et cetera, are well-known to their fellows, but many of these men will be getting to really know each other for the first time.
Yeah. As you mentioned, many of the cardinals are now from Central America, South America, Asia. What does this say about how John Paul has reached out to the developing world and how well he understands it?
Well, he certainly has made a great effort to reach out, not only through the appointment of cardinals, but his many visits, his attempts to bring attention to the problems of the global South. So all those factors. And he also recognizes that the global South is where the church is growing, at least numerically, where there are large numbers of vocations, where even as religious practice in Europe dwindles, religious practice has grown. And in many ways, that's going to be an interesting dynamic that the next pope and his successors will have to deal with, is that there's going to be a shift in where the center of dynamism in Catholicism is, and it's more likely to be found in the global South than it is in the traditional Catholic lands of Europe and North America.
Hmm.
In many ways, not unlike the identity struggle that the Anglican Communion is currently undergoing, with tensions between the Mother Church in Britain and the U.S. Episcopal Church, and the more dynamic, growing, and in the eyes of some, more fundamentalist-leaning churches in Africa and Asia.
Hmm. Is schism something that has to be of concern?
I would tend to say no, in the sense that schism, formal break, the Catholic Church has, in recent years, has shown a great ability to, despite all the tensions in the since Vatican II, to maintain at least a corporate unity. Now, the extent to which that unity is actually lived on a day-to-day basis, that will remain to be seen. I think it's one of the issues that John Paul's successor will address as different areas of the world grow differently, have different priorities, different concerns. That's going to be a tension. It's going to be perhaps almost a full-time job description of the next pope.
Hmm. Among the cardinals who will elect the next pope, there are a group called Grand Electors.
Yes.
They will play an important role. Who are they, and what kind of, how does their power differ from their colleagues?
Well, each cardinal elector has one vote. However, if you will, some votes carry more weight than others. By law, between the death of a pope and the beginning of the conclave to elect his successor, there's anywhere between 2 weeks and 3 weeks. So that's a rather lengthy period of time when you consider that that interval was put in there originally to facilitate steamship travel to Rome. So now, within 48 hours of John Paul's passing, almost all the cardinals will be in Rome, and they'll have 2 to 3 weeks to caucus, to visit with each other. And there will be certain cardinals who will be in a position to influence the election by either public pronouncements or the fact that they will host their fellows. First and foremost among them will be Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the doctrinal watchdog for John Paul's pontificate. Cardinal Ratzinger is the dean of the Sacred College of Cardinals, the first among equals, and he will preside at all the meetings of the cardinals after John Paul's death, and celebrate his funeral mass and deliver the eulogy. So those will be all occasions when he can speak and, by, if you will, in his speeches, profile his views of what sort of challenges lay ahead, and therefore what figures might, without mentioning names, of course, what figures might fill those criteria. Another influential person is going to be Cardinal Angelo Sodano, the current Cardinal Secretary of State, John Paul's closest collaborator in the government of the Church, and many will look to him for his pronouncements, subtle, quietly, but about who he favors. Giovanni Battista Re, an Italian cardinal, former papal diplomat who heads the Congregation for Bishops, the office that appoints bishops in most of Europe, and the Americas, will certainly carry a great deal of influence. Now, there is Crescenzo Seppi, another Italian. He heads the office in charge of the Church in the developing world, and many of the cardinals from the developing world will avail themselves of the conclave to pay calls for on him. So he's another one who will influence others. Karl Lehmann, who's the president of the German Bishops' Conference and the Cardinal Bishop of Mainz in Germany, has had numerous contacts in the developing world because of the German church's assistance to churches in those areas. And so, again, he will no doubt host many of the cardinals who he has assisted in the past and will have an ability to at least signal his preferences to them.
Mm. And can you give us some sense of the top candidates?
Certainly. Before I do that, if I may, part of how I discern, or I think an observer ought to discern, who might be a candidate for the papacy, mm-hmm. is really to look at what the job now requires. Because in many ways, both the evolution of our society and John Paul's personal stamp on the papacy has changed the job description. Certainly, whoever is elected has to be a man of a certain physical stamina. Otherwise, after John Paul's many travels around the world, his grueling day-to-day schedule, anyone who does less will be compared rather unfavorably. If you look at our political arena, that's what happened to Colin Powell as Secretary of State in the United States. He rarely traveled. That's not to say he wasn't effective, but his lack of travel was compared very unfavorably with his predecessor, Madeleine Albright's many travels. So certainly physical stamina is a requirement for the papacy now. Intellectual abilities. And by these, I mean just general intellectual culture, as well as a basic knowledge for languages. The Pope is the Bishop of Rome, so any candidate for the papacy has to speak the language of the city of Rome, Italian. Latin remains the official language of the church, at least for its formal business at the central level, so a Pope has to know Latin. English, because of the world in which we live and the importance of English in communications. French remains the diplomatic language of the Holy See, so a Pope who is engaged in all these diplomatic activities has to know French. German is very important for theological developments, both conservative and progressive in the last 50 years. All the works have been done in German. And Spanish for the large numbers of faithful in Latin America as well as the Iberian Peninsula. So you're talking about at least six or seven languages that any reasonable candidate would be expected to know. In addition to this, the cardinals will probably want someone who has pastoral experience, a sense of what it is to be out there in a diocese. On the other hand, the Pope is also the central administrator of the church, and so one also has to have an ability for administrative detail and central government. So if you look at all these characteristics, boiling down, I come up with a list of at most maybe half a dozen cardinals who could potentially fill the shoes of John Paul II.
Yeah. Do you want to mention just a couple? We don't have a lot of time left, but maybe you would tell us, just give us a sense of who a couple of these men are.
Certainly. One is Dionigio Tettamanzi, the Archbishop of Milan, theologian, bioethicist. He ghostwrote many of John Paul's writings on moral theology. Angelo Scola, the Patriarch of Venice, again, another intellectual. He's been relatively active recently in interreligious dialogue with Islam, another Italian. Another one, Severino Poletta, the Archbishop of Turin, sort of a moderate figure who has no major enemies, be a holdover. Two non-Italian candidates that pop up are often discussed. One is Francis Arinze. He's getting on in his 70s, but he's a Nigerian cardinal who's worked in the Vatican the last two decades, and he's spoken of as a transitional figure. Doctrinally, he's very conservative. On the other hand, coming from the global south, that would send a great signal to the church in the developing world. And finally, Christoph Schönborn, the Archbishop of Vienna in Austria. His drawback is he's probably one of the youngest cardinals, and they'd be hesitant to elect someone who would outlive them all. On the other hand, he was the editor of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, a first-rate theologian, a great mind, and the fact that he's worked very hard in the last few years in a very difficult pastoral situation in Vienna, where his predecessor, Cardinal Greer, was forced to resign in disgrace after it was revealed he was involved in personally involved in a number of sexual scandals. And so Cardinal Schönborn has kept the Austrian church together under very difficult circumstances. So a number of people admire him for his abilities there.
Yeah. It's interesting, you talked about, you know, the ability to keep up with the physical demands of the job, the requirement that one be multilingual, the desire for pastoral experience. Also, though, something that you mentioned in the book, you note John Paul's gifts as a human being, one of the most humanly gifted men ever to occupy the throne of Peter. Will a candidate's charisma play a role in his chances for election?
Very definitely. And in many ways, it's unfortunate in the sense that there are many gifted people who lack charisma or are not photogenic, and certainly some of the great popes in history would never pass this particular test. But we live in the times in which we live, and media image is very important. A Benedict XV, for example, Pope from 1914 to 1922, he originated many of the international principles of peace and law that were later incorporated by President Wilson into his 14 points. A very gifted man who worked very hard to mediate the conflict, would never be elected today for the very reason that he was one of the most, by his own admission, one of the most physically unimpressive individuals ever to be elected to the papacy. He was hunchbacked, very short, was agoraphobic and hated large numbers of people. Certainly, he certainly served the church in a tremendously capacity during those difficult war years, but would be unthinkable as a candidate today.
Once a new pope is elected, what might this man do at the outset of his papacy to signal to the world something about the kind of pope he wants to be, that he will be?
Well, traditionally, the first signal that a pope sends of his intentions has been the name he's chosen for his papacy. John Paul I, for example, signaled that he wanted to combine both John the 23rd's goodness with Paul the VI's practical wisdom and intellectual work, and really hard. So he chose the name John Paul, becoming the first double-named pope in history. After he'd passed away, after only 33 days, John Paul II chose the same name to identify himself with that sense of continuity. Earlier in the 20th century, Pius the 10th took the name Pius to signal that he wanted to go back to the pontificate of Pius the 9th and signaled a break with Leo the 13th's more progressive legacy. So the choice of a name will be very important. A pope who chooses the name Paul, for example, would probably signal that he's very open to the world. One who John would harken back to John the 23rd. A John Paul would promise continuity with the current pontificate. Mm-hmm. So really the choice of name would be the first clue, at least, into the thinking of the pope.
Yeah. One more question here at the end, and then we have to wrap up. What kind of look inside the conclave do you think we'll glimpse this time?
This time, I think it's going to be very interesting. It will be the first conclave held under entirely modern conditions. They'll be living in suites in a newly built palace as opposed to makeshift rooms. Even though communication with the outside world is strictly forbidden, it's almost inevitable, unfortunately, that there's going to be intrusion, whether it be through cell phones, Blackberries, the maid whispering. It's not going to be as close. I think they're going to have a very difficult time controlling that. And the number of journalists who will be accredited to cover it will be unprecedented. Already for years now, there have been major networks that have been paying rent for Roman rooftops for a decade in the anticipation of having it available. So they're going to be under greater scrutiny than ever before. And quite possibly this is going to be, really, it's a first test case. They'll set the standard by which future conclaves will be held.
John Peter Pham, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
The pleasure's mine.
John Peter Pham is the author of Heirs of the Fisherman, Behind the Scenes of Papal Death and Succession. The book is published by Oxford University Press. And I spoke with John Peter Pham yesterday, Monday, the 21st of February. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, what a day at the board today. Futures in the corn pit up 7.5 cents. The bean pit up around 25, 29 cents for the day. We'll get to all the details during the closing market report this afternoon at 6 after this next hour, 2 o'clock Central Time, when we talk to Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. A lot to be said about drying conditions in Argentina and southern Brazil in particular. We definitely want to check in with our meteorologist, Don Day, a little later this afternoon to see if that donut he talked about last week, where those dry conditions would be in the center of the donut, southern Brazil and northern Argentina, has actually moved into parts of Mato Grosso. When we talked with plant pathologist, Dean Malvick, down there earlier, late last week, and we'll hear that interview this afternoon during the closing market report. He said that they did have dry conditions in the area he was in, about 20 days worth at that point without rain. So let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade today as we try to figure out why this market has moved so sharply to the higher side. Futures in the wheat pit for the day up 16.5 cents in that March contract, with a high of 320, a low of 297.5, a settlement price there at $3.12. They were up 16.5. May futures 328, the high, the low at 306. Settlement price at 320.75, up 16.75. And July futures in the wheat pit 334, the high, the low at 313.25. A settlement price at 325.5, and they were up 14.5. September futures 338.5, the high, the low at $3.20, settled 333, up 16.5 today. December contract 348.5, the high, the low at 328, settlement price at $3.40, up 16.25. From the corn pit, the nearby March contract at 209 high, low at 202.5, settlement price at 207.5. They were up 7.5 cents for the day. 209, I believe, is the 100-day moving average, but we'll have to double check on that one. May futures 217, the high, the low at 210.25. Settlement price at $2.15. They were up 7.5 as well. And the July contract in the corn pit, 223.75, the high from the Board of Trade, the low at 217.25. July settled at 222.25, up 7.5. September up 6.75 today, 230 the high, the low at 224.5, and a settlement price at 228.25. December contract, this is for your new crop corn, 239.5 the high, the low at 234, settled at $2.37 a bushel. They were up 5.5 cents. The March contract 5.5 higher as well, 246 the high, the low at 41, a settlement for the March 06 corn at $2.44, up 5.5 cents. March oats unchanged on the day, 162.5 the high, the low at 159, a settlement price at 159.5. They are unchanged. And the May oats up 3.5 cents today, with a settlement price of $1.54.75, a high at 55 and a low at 52. From the soy complex, now here's where most of the fireworks happened for the day. Everything else following the beans up. Dry conditions in parts of South America, 583 the high, low at 559. Settlement price at $5.77. They were up 24.5 for the day. May futures at 588.5 high, low at 563.25. Settlement price at $5.83 a bushel, up 27.25. And July futures 593, the high, the low at 568, settlement price at 588.75, up 29.5. And the August contract at 594 high, low at $5.71, settled 590 even, up 28 cents for the day. September futures at 591 high, low at 571, settlement price $5.90 even there as well. The September contract up 28.25. And the new crop November beans were up 25.75. The high $5.99 today, the low at $5.77.5, a settlement price at $5.96. Once again, that new crop November bean contract up 25.75 for the day. The March bean meal now, 176.80, the high, the low at 170.10, settlement price at 175.50. They were up 6.30 for the day. And the May bean meal, a 179 high, low at 171.20, settlement price at 176.60. They were up 6.60 for the day. Bean oil futures now, March contract at 22.04, the high, the low at 20.43, settlement price at 21.75, up a dollar, up 168 for the day. That's $1.68. And the May bean oil up $1.70 today, 22.18, the high, the low at 20.55, and a settlement price at 21.90, and once again they were up $1.70 for the day. That last contract sort of surprised me. I didn't realize bean oil had rallied quite that much. We'll definitely have to talk with Wayne Nelson during the closing market report about that particular bit of the market. Just in case you're tuning in late, here's a recap of how things went at the Board of Trade. March beans up 24.5 cents in the nearby March contract. The Novembers were up 25.75. Corn up 5 to 7.5 cents for the day. We'll take all of that up during the closing market report. Comes up at 6 after this next hour. Now, with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. We had four contracts that finished lower today on the Merc. The rest finished higher. March feeder cattle, the high 99.05, the low 97.80, the settlement 98.50, that up 20. April, 98.20 the high, 97.30 the low, 97.72.5 the settlement, that down 12.5. May, 97.25 the high, 96.40 the low, the settlement 97.10, that unchanged. February live cattle, 88.75 the high, 88.10 the low, 88.30 the settlement, that down 65. March, 89.60 the high, 87.90 the low, 87.90 the settlement, that down 190. April live cattle, 86 even the high, 85.30 the low, 85.55 the settlement, that up 10. April lean hog, 73.85, the high, the low, 73 even, finishing at 73.55, up 67.5. May, 75.50, the high, 74.70, the low, 75.50, the settlement, that up 37.5. June lean hog, 77.95, the high, 77.15, the low, 77.80, the settlement, that up 32.5. And July lean hog, 74.40, the high, 73.80, the low, 74.15, the settlement, that up 12.5. February pork bellies, 87.50, the high, the low, 86 even, the settlement, 86.70, that down 42.5. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 138 points at 10,647. The S&P 500 down 14 points at 1188, and the NASDAQ off 20 at 2038.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
Today, all things considered in Egypt, we'll hear about relations with the U.S., the state of multi-party democracy, what young graduates say about their prospects, and what a movie in the making says about their country. It's based on a controversial bestseller by an opposition columnist.
We don't have the freedom of speech. We have the freedom of talk.
Our week in the Middle East begins today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 Central on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Walt Staples from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I understand that the dinosaurs died when a comet hit the Earth. Is it possible the same thing will happen to vertebrate paleontologists?"
No, you can't kill something that's already dead. The kind of person who becomes a vertebrate paleontologist is the kind of guy or gal who never really made it past the birth experience. Some part of him or her is still unborn, hiding, refusing to face life on life's terms. Let's face it, paleontology makes library science seem downright exciting in comparison. No, some of us bite off a big chunk of life and chew it until the bitter end, and some of us take our first half-hearted nibble and immediately choke on it.
Thank you, Dr. Science.
Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th